Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week we're talking about the tennis film The Battle of the Sexes and the festive Netflix original film A Christmas Prince.
Caroline has also watched The Good Place for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We've been looking through the emails, haven't we, Caroline?
We have indeed. And Barbara Reese from Brazil has been in touch to say, huge fan of the show, and I think you conduct some of the best conversations / analysis on pop culture on the internet. Oh, thank you. I am not at all made arrogant by that. But she also has a question. She says, I've been plagued by something that I've no idea if you can answer, but I thought I might give it a try. Have you heard any news about the BBC's His Dark Materials adaptation? I remember it was announced in late 2015, and then we were pretty much left in the dark, except for tiny bits of info every now and then, mostly from Pullman's Twitter. I was terribly excited to see it, and I'm truly bummed by its MIA status. So, Anna, do we know anything about this?
Well, I'm kind of in the same position as Barbara. I can't believe it was late 2015 that it was announced. That seems like
so long ago,
nearly 2 years ago. But the last we heard about it, so this is for people who don't know, the BBC are adapting the His Dark Materials series. They said that Jack Thorne was the writer they'd attached to it. And then I don't think we had anything else really apart from that it was happening and that he was going to be writing it. There's no cast announcements or anything like that. And the last thing we heard about it, and we just did a quick Google, was April 2017. Which was when Jack Thorne said he was still very much early on in the writing process and talked about that a bit with the Radio Times.
Yeah, I wonder whether the fact that Philip Pullman's been doing the Book of Dust has meant that he's taken a bit of a back seat and therefore it's going a lot slower.
I don't know. And also, obviously, Jack Thorne must have been doing Cursed Child stuff maybe still in late 2015. When did Cursed Child come out? Was it summer 2015?
Yeah.
Or 2016? Summer 2016?
Yeah.
I think. So he probably
summer 2016, I think, yeah.
Still doing that at first. But yeah, I don't know why it is moving so slowly. It's also the kind of thing that you can imagine will have loads of post-production time on it. So even after they've announced it and filmed it, we're still going to have quite a long time to wait, I think.
Yeah, I would say 2019 at the earliest would be my estimation based on the kind of scope of it, definitely. So yeah, that is sad. But thank you for reminding us that it is allegedly happening, Barbara. We'll keep an eye out for it.
We've also had an email from Laura Snapes, who got in touch to say that she agreed about the Didion documentary. She says it perpetuated the idea of her as a cute lifestyle, which is, yeah, it's kind of disappointing. And she says it's sad because most people who'd want to watch a Joan Didion documentary would surely want something much more forensic and craft-led.
Very true.
Then she says the discussion reminded her of how brilliant the Roger Ebert documentary Life itself is, as far as docs about writers go. I haven't seen it. Yeah, Roger Ebert, he was the Chicago Sun-Times film critic. Now there's like rogerebert.com where lots of really great critics write for.
Yeah.
So yeah, Laura's recommending this documentary about him. She says it's so detailed about his work, but also his beautiful relationship with his wife. I don't know anyone who has seen it and hasn't cried. It's a gorgeous human story, and there's an extra layer of delight there for writers and journalists. It's on Netflix. Well, that sounds like a great recommend, especially for people who maybe watched the Didion one and were disappointed.
I really want to try that, not least because my boyfriend is a massive Roger Ebert fan.
Oh, great.
Yeah, he really, really likes him. Also, I think his wife was on an episode of the Death, Sex and Money podcast.
Oh, cool. Great
not
podcast.
Not that long after he died. And she talked really interestingly about kind of actually Didion ideas about how she was really convinced that she could still feel his presence for like a year after he died. And she sort of got quite into various like spiritualist ideas about the soul and all this kind of thing to try and explain why she had this feeling. It was really interesting.
That's so cool. Well, two great recommends we've ended up with there. Both that documentary and the podcast episode. So thanks so much for getting in touch, everyone. Should we roll on with the show?
Yeah, let's do it. The first thing we're going to talk about this week is The Battle of the Sexes, which is a historical biopic portraying the events leading up to the 1973 tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. It stars Emma Stone as King and Steve Carell as Riggs, and focuses on the characters' personal lives and the febrile state of gender relations, as well as on the tennis.
Yeah, so it's really a kind of film about an event, a very iconic sporting event, but that is saved for right towards the end of the film. It's the climactic sequence, and we get a lot of stuff about Billie Jean King's life, her work, her relationships, all leading up to that moment in 73.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of making a film about Billie Jean King, really, isn't it? Because I feel like she is someone whose life and work would stand up to a more conventional biopic, you know? But they've chosen to show it through the prism of this one event, which, from what I've been able to tell reading about it, I have to say I hadn't really heard of it before seeing the trailer for this film. But I was interested and I did go read a bit about it.
There was a documentary made about it, I think, recently.
There was.
That was popular, yeah. And I think that kind of encouraged some retrospective analysis of the event.
But it was a massive deal. Like, it's really hard, I think, maybe to appreciate now, but something like 90 million people watched it on television.
Yeah.
And it was this, somehow became this kind of cultural flashpoint in the early 70s for all these things, political things that were swirling around, like Nixon was president, all this kind of stuff, like hippies versus squares, men versus women, housewives versus career women, like somehow all this one tennis match came to stand in for all of those things.
Yeah. And it's a real kind of spectacle, isn't it? More, like, it's hard to know how much this match between, you know, man versus woman actually made an impact in terms of any sort of attitude changes or legislation changes or anything like that. But it was this massive, massive spectacle, regardless of how much it actually did for, you know, equality in sport.
Well, I mean, I think it was like one small step on the way. It certainly wasn't the case that like Billie Jean King, spoiler alert, smashed him and then immediately all women sports stars were paid the same as men. And that was the end of it. I mean, I think I read that equal pay at Wimbledon only came in 2007 or something like that. You know, at the beginning of her career, Serena Williams was being paid a lot less than men.
But there's also this whole, a lot of the film deals with more specific kind of activism changes that, that, you know, that I think the fact that they're starting up their own women's league of tennis players is perhaps more important in how they come to get, you know, fairer pay for women in and fairer prize monies. So yeah, it's an interesting film. For me, it's kind of one of those films where it doesn't fit easily into a box. It's not, as you say, a conventional biopic. It's more a film about an event, but then it's also not really that much about the event. It's so much about like her love life, and there's some really beautiful romantic scenes in it between Emma Stone and Andrea Riseborough, which are lovely. But I just struggle to know like what the film is like doing or saying, if that makes sense, because it was enjoyable, but it wasn't like a piece of social activism, and it wasn't like a romance, beautiful, aesthetic, gorgeous, unified romance movie. Like, there were lots of nice details about it that I really liked. I thought at the beginning, when the romance between these two characters is just beginning, you get all these kind of like very almost like Petra Collins-esque, lush 70s, soft, nicely lit scenes with neon, and, you know, all of that's really, really gorgeous. And then their sex scenes are really beautifully done. And then later on, I like the way that it starts to kind of like layer what it would have looked like on the TV at the time, that sort of oversaturated, yellowy 70s look with the actual way that the match is being filmed for us in the audience. But, you know, the point of the film, it's not like a film like Moonlight or something where the aesthetics are so integral to what it's doing. And it's also not a normal biopic, and it's also not really a piece of event TV. And it's like very funny in parts and very enjoyable, but it's also not like a social justice movie. So I'm kind of like, I don't know, there's something for me that's a little unfocused about it, maybe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I experienced that sort of in real time, because I went to see the film and then I went and did some shopping afterwards, and I came home and my boyfriend asked me, oh, how was the film? And I was like, oh yeah, I did go and see a film, didn't I? It was only like 2 hours later and I'd already forgotten. And not because the film is, in the cliched way, eminently forgettable, just because it didn't make a deep impact on me once I'd left the cinema.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed, for instance, Alan Cumming's excellent, like, gay fairy godmother character.
Oh my God, I hated it.
Did you? I thought he was amazing.
I thought he was terrible. I thought he was like Willy Wonka coming into these scenes and ruining them.
No, totally.
I was like, you're in a different movie. Go away. Where are you?
That's what I loved about it. That's what I loved about it.
God, it was so over the top and so ridiculous.
It was so self-consciously like, hi, I am a gay person who does clothes.
Yeah.
I thought was hilarious.
And it was very like, they gave him like the emotional last line of the movie. I think, again, because the movie is a bit like, oh, so what was the point of this? And then there's like, it's got nothing really to say. So it's like, instead they make it about, you know, this guy hugging her and saying like, one day you'll be able to love who you love openly. And it's a bit, it just feels a bit like, I don't, you know, you can tell that that moment didn't really happen. And it just feels a bit, I don't know. Like, here we go, here's Gene Wilder coming in at the end. Just a bit bizarre.
No, I love that. I mean, it was one of the worst, objectively one of the worst things about the film. But I liked, I don't know, I found him amusing in this sort of fake fairy godmother role.
By rights, that should have been a Stanley Tucci role.
Absolutely. I assume scheduling conflicts prevented him. Because obviously he will have been the first choice. But I thought both Emma Stone and Steve Carell were very good in this.
Yeah, great performances from both of them, definitely.
Really great performances. And I mean, I don't watch a huge amount of sport movies, but I thought they handled the like sport aspects of it quite well, in that other than the actual match itself, which is obviously the main focus of the film, we didn't have to like watch body doubles playing tennis a lot.
No, it was quite, they did it quite efficiently. It was quite a slim portion of the movie, but quite, they were quite exciting, those scenes. Yeah, I agree that the two leads are both really good. I don't know if this is being pushed as like Oscar performances for either of them, but
I'm not aware of it. I've read, I don't know about you, but I've read a couple of like Oscar-y lists so far, and I haven't seen it on any of them.
My boyfriend was saying he thinks they'll push Steve Carell for supporting actor for that role, which, I mean, it's a great performance and he is very likable. And Steve Carell's obviously got like a whole background in playing likable but like deeply politically incorrect characters.
Yeah.
And that pays off here, because there's a whole kind of line of like, he's not really that sexist, he's just like trying to make some money, he's a hustler, he just wants to like gain the spotlight. But I also thought that that message doesn't translate very well in 2017, where these figures like Trump and Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg are actually so scary for their like performed misogyny. Yeah.
I did think that when, you know, all the stuff when he was like handing her a pig and wearing t-shirts saying male chauvinist pig, I did get a bit of a chill looking at the shots of the crowd, because, you know, and that phrase that I think of so much these days, like, when someone tells you who they are the first time, believe them.
Yeah.
And I just thought, he's here, he is saying, hi, I'm a male chauvinist pig. And in that sense, Billie Jean King is right in the way she handles it, because she just says, yeah, you are. Let's play tennis so I can show you that I'm better than you.
Yeah. But there's a line, isn't there? They give her a line where there's this figure of Jack who's kind of like in charge. He's an ex-tennis player who's like in charge of the tennis leagues and deciding prize money and stuff. And she says to him, like, you know, Bobby Riggs, is his misogyny is performative and doesn't run deep, but you're like the real misogynist. And that line to me felt a bit like, well, actually we can't really say things like that anymore, because performative, you know, misogyny and racism and stuff actually can be more dangerous.
Yeah.
Is what we've learned, and can still be the exact same thing as like genuine deep running hatred of minority groups. So it's just, yeah, ugh. I thought about comparing it a bit to Joy, which is another kind of sort of biopic about someone who's got like an interesting story. Like, as you say, Billie Jean King's perfectly worthy of a full biopic, but that's not what this was. Both of them were in kind of aesthetically a bit interesting, but ultimately, I don't think we're ever going to revisit Joy and be like, that was a great movie.
No.
And I think I feel the same about this, maybe.
Yeah, I think I agree. So I think it's a perfectly nice outing to the cinema, but I don't think it's, you know, necessarily going to challenge for any big awards or linger long.
Maybe.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is the Netflix original film, A Christmas Prince, starring Rose McIver as an American journalist sent to cover a succession crisis in the snowy European country of, quote, Aldovia. While there, she gets drawn into the personal lives of the royal family she is supposed to be reporting on, who'd have thunk it, and forms an attachment to the troubled Prince Richard and his sister Emily. Yeah. I mean, literally everything that you could possibly imagine to happen in a film with the premise undercover reporter goes to cover life of handsome prince happens.
Yes.
I think you could write it from the armchair, yes. You know. So yeah, even the credits sequence I found to be very, very nostalgic of early noughties rom-coms, mm-hmm. in that it, or even earlier, it has the same title sequence as What a Girl Wants,
yes.
and You've Got Mail, where mm-hmm. it's like a kind of CGI New York City skyscape, and then you like zoom into certain streets and stuff while all the credits are rolling. And then she's like a journalist, working at this magazine called Now Beat magazine. And I don't understand what sort of magazine it is that is like interested in like celebs, but also like the kind of obscure succession crises of minor European countries.
My best guess is it's like Hello or OK.
But then why do they give a shit about this, this political crisis?
Have you looked in Hello or OK recently? Like, they cover the most I read it sometimes in like the doctor's waiting room and stuff. They cover the most obscure things as long as the people are handsome.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So actually that was quite believable to me that such a magazine would do that, because it was like, he's handsome. We don't care where this place is. It's obviously politically totally irrelevant, but you know, whatever.
That's so funny. I kind of loved and hated the terrible magazine editor performance who's there like, hey kid, I'm going to need you to go to Aldovia.
Yeah, she's amazing.
You've got to cover His Royal Hotness. This is your big break, kid.
Yeah.
I've got no one else to send.
I found the like brief journalism in New York scene before she heads off, in some ways, as you say, hilarious, but in other ways, kind of too real in some other ways, like the horrible interaction she has with a man whose copy, so she's working as a sort of sub-editor, a horrible interaction she has with this male writer who's like, yeah, I know I wrote twice as much and it's all terrible, just fix it, will you just rewrite it for like no credit or pay, just do it. And then,
yeah, but also she's not a sub editor, she's a junior editor. And her big dream is to become a writer, and yeah. You're like, you're in a way more senior and secure job than like a freelance writer. You're a junior editor. That's a great position.
But also,
love it, babe.
The fact that she like goes over to her junior editor colleagues and is like, oh, the only way I can really prove myself and get my career on track is to take this random reporting assignment because being an editor just isn't valued at this publication. And I was like,
yeah. Where do you work?
I've never heard of this before. This definitely has not happened to me. But
I love it. Also, shout out to the best friend minorities.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're like, we'll have a black woman and a gay guy. And then every time she has a sort of problem, she like either calls her dad or like tunes in for another episode of Skyping with the Minorities,
yep.
Where she like literally video calls her like best friends from home, and they get to have like the occasional line of like, you can do it. You should run your story. That's like it. That's the extent of their characters.
Their advice really is so generic as well. It's like, yeah, you should totally go, girl, is the kind of thing the gay guy
it's
says.
Like, totally emotionless and dead. I mean, I feel like a good way to describe this whole film is that it's very nostalgic for those early noughties films, but has decided not to progress in any way from that point, when obviously it's like nearly 20 years later, and like the way that we think plots and characters should function has changed a lot. And on top of that, they've decided to just drop the quality of the acting and the script writing by like two levels. So it's like even more terribly written and performed, and just like has no redeeming qualities 20 years on.
Mm.
Right.
As you say, it's kind of emotionless in some ways. Like, you know, you're supposed to be having, quote, feelings because it's very snowy and the prince is very handsome and all of this kind of stuff. But I did not have feelings of great investment in any of the characters or storylines in this.
No.
But I do have to caveat that with, I did very much enjoy it nonetheless.
Oh, me too. I watched it at a friend's house with like a bunch of friends, and we were all like screaming every line before they said it because it's so obvious. I think perhaps the weirdest thing about this film is that it has no like arc.
Mm-mm.
There's no pacing to anything. There's just like lots of short scenes. Like every scene could be from the like beginning of the movie or the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Like there's no development, there's no sense of like progression at all. And every scene is like will give you whiplash in the way that it's like, hi, I'm really angry with you. Now I love you. Now I'm angry again. Like within the space of like 5 seconds. Like it's a bit like a Simon Cowell kind of like, and I'm really sorry to say that you're in the final. Like everyone's like lying for a second in every scene where they're like, I'm really disappointed that you went tobogganing without me, but next time, where's my invite? And you're like, what is this? Nobody talks like this. It's terrible.
Yeah. So if anyone is thinking of watching this film because, you know, they love The Princess Diaries or What a Girl Wants or whatever,
it is a rip of The Princess Diaries.
It is a rip of those films. But it is not equal to them in terms of either comedy or emotional value. But the way you said you watched it is exactly how one should watch it. I wonder if actually Netflix have done a genius thing here where they've identified that this is exactly the film people want to watch at their like friends' Christmas weekend before everyone heads off to their families for Christmas.
While getting drunk and like being like, I could have written this.
Exactly.
Because you can literally run through it and be like, this scene is from The Princess Diaries, exactly. This scene is from She's All That, exactly. This scene is from Beauty and the Beast, where she gets lost in the forest and all these wolves arrive, like, exactly. And that was totally, I agree. I'm like, either they're really, really dumb or they're really, really, really smart.
I think they're really smart, yeah. So I think they know that people love all those movies, and what they've done is repackaged them with a satisfying amount of shitness so that you can scream at the TV. And a lovely like snowy festive setting, because I did really enjoy all the like exterior shots of nice castles in the snow.
It didn't look like a real royal village. It looked like, instead, you know those episodes of Keeping Up with the Kardashians where Scott Disick decides he's going to be Lord Disick and like hires a suit of armor and some like monogrammed slippers? That's what it looked like.
Oh yeah,
it looked like Scott Disick had been like, I want to live in a cool European castle, and so he'd just gone to one of those pubs that has like old-timey wood cladding inside, and that's it.
Yeah.
Really terrible.
And just to, you know, spoil the whole actual plot for a second, the like succession line thing where oh no, the prince might be adopted, oh wait, but his dad actually secretly changed the law, so that's fine, all that stuff is totally absurd, and almost you can like nap through those bits and like nothing terrible would happen. Another great reason why this is a good film to watch on a slightly sleepy drunk afternoon, because you could fall asleep for 10 minutes and it would be fine.
Yeah, totally. It's bizarre that they think that we'd be interested in minor legal disputes.
Yeah. No. As you would expect, of course, there is a like evil countess character who's trying to manipulate the succession in the wrong way, and there's a ball scene or something, and she's wearing a kind of red vampy dress, and I was watching this with headphones on, and Guy came in and looked over my shoulder and he was like, is she the baddie? I was like,
yeah,
yes,
exactly.
How could you tell?
I mean, they have the faces of baddies, but also I love that it's like it's just so dumb that it's like woman wants power, evil, mm-hmm. man wants power, good sense of duty and responsibility, yes. very good noble man, and yes. you're like, this is so terrible. It's so transparent
And just to completely wreck it for the very, very end bit when the prince comes to the humble diner where Cinderella, I mean, the journalist, is working now, to propose in the snowy midnight street on New Year's Eve, etc. And she accepts. And then she's like, oh, no, but what about my father? What about my life here? What about my career? And he essentially just goes, I'll fix it with all my money.
We could move it. Yeah. We'll just move your dad's restaurant. It'll be fine. Yeah, it's really bizarre. Some of my favourite scenes in this movie included, I liked the bit where the prince was missing.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone was like, where will he be? And his sister was like, I know where he'll be. And just like goes to an orphanage. And then she's like, look, there he is playing with the poor children. He's always here. And you're like, what? This is so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I also liked the bit where she's like inexplicably riding a horse. And yeah. we're all like, where did she learn to ride a horse? And I'm like, oh, she's from New York. So Central Park. And then she's like, I learned to ride my horse in Central Park. And you're like, oh my God, who is writing this? Like, it's so terrible. I can't even begin, but it was great fun.
It was great fun. And as you know, we're now very nearly at the end of December, and you know, festive things. I've definitely seen on my Twitter and Instagram, people are already watching Love Actually.
Yeah, I mean, Love Actually, really, when you look into it, is not a whole lot better, is it?
No, but God, no.
It just is. The performances are better. It's more charming. It's just like, oh. You just can't. I don't know where that Christmas magic comes from, but I've only had it so far this year in Paddington 2. Nothing else has really tickled that for me. And maybe The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I'm pinning all my hopes on that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what you make of it. Anyway, A Christmas Prince. Watch it or don't, but it's bad. So last week, I recommended that Caroline watch The Good Place. I feel like before we discuss this show, it's important to know how far along you got, Caroline. So how much of The Good Place did you watch?
I've watched all available episodes.
Have you?
Yes.
Oh my God, me too. That's so funny.
I got completely... So I was quite ill last week and I had like a day in bed. And I literally watched like 14 episodes in a day.
No way.
It's so shameful.
That's so good though, because I feel like it would have been sad to talk about The Good Place and be like, oh yeah, The Good Place, this is what the premise is, because spoiler alert for anyone listening, there is quite a big twist at the end of season one. So I think we're probably going to discuss that today.
We are. So if you have not seen the twist yet and are planning to, skip ahead to the end and we'll see you next week.
Yeah. So the premise is that they're in the good place, but Eleanor Shellstrop, the protagonist played by Kristen Bell, does not belong there, has been this case of mistaken identity, actually should definitely be in the bad place. And then
it's a heaven and hell thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the good place is heaven and the bad place is hell. And she's dead. some key info there. And then as it goes on, every day that the four main characters, Eleanor, her quote soulmate, Chidi, this woman called Tahani, who's like a kind of socialite, charity, do-gooder person, and her...
Played by Jameela Jamil, which is...
from T4.
Amazing.
Brits will remember from T4. Great casting for her and a great role. Really ramping up a ridiculous posh English accent. And then her soulmate, who's a Buddhist monk, slash guy called Jason from Florida, who's pretending to be a Buddhist monk in the same way that Eleanor's pretending to be good Eleanor. And then as it goes on, you realize that they're literally miserable every single episode because they're so stressed about their situation. Mm-hmm. And eventually Eleanor kind of realizes that actually, if she's in heaven, why is she like literally so stressed all the time? And then Michael, who is the architect of heaven, so like he's kind of an angel or demon like figure who's been in charge of like making sure they're happy. She's like, hang on, we're in the bad place to him. And he's like, does an evil laugh. And so then that's the big twist in the series, is that actually they've been in hell all along, which mm-hmm. is an interesting place to go, right?
It is. Although I have to say, this probably sounds like horrible and smug, I did guess about three episodes out that was
did
what was
you
gonna happen.
I didn't see it coming. Yes. At all.
The thing I wasn't sure about was whether Michael was in on it or not. Mm. I wasn't sure if he was actually like a good place architect who'd been duped by someone, or whether he'd actually designed this hell for them. Obviously it turns out to be the latter, but the reason why I thought that was going to happen was partly because as you say, like, you have just watched like 12 episodes of them being like, I'm so unhappy, even though they're supposed to be in heaven. But also, it is kind of the logical place for a show about heaven and hell to go, especially when the series one had gone on and we hadn't actually seen hell ever.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about
it. That was for
it.
Me the giveaway. We kept hearing about it and we met a couple of people from it. But I was like, why don't you show it to us? Unless this is it, you know?
Yeah. That's very smart, because I did not get there. I was really surprised by the twist. But one thing that I thought gave there were some clues. Like, for example, the day she arrives, like, every single shop there is a frozen yogurt shop.
Yep.
And you're like, cool, but no one really loves frozen yogurt that much. And I thought it was because you're not really meant to identify so much with the characters who are actually good.
Mm.
You're meant to identify more with the people who are like, have done bad things in their lives. And like, so I wondered if frozen yogurt was like a thing that good people really enjoy, because and all the rest of us bad lot like proper ice cream. You know, I thought maybe that was the joke. But one thing I have to say is, this show, I'm like someone who worries quite a lot about whether I'm a good person or a bad person. And this show really plays on that for me. So sometimes
really
I don't
does.
Enjoy it, because I'm like, all of these characters that are supposedly evil and have gone to hell have never done anything that bad.
I know, they're not murderers, and they're not, you know... They're just like selfish people.
Yeah, like they're a bit self-interested, a bit like Chidi's main character flaw is that he's indecisive, which is like not a bad thing at all, and like supposedly hurts people in his life by like not being able to make decisions. Tahani's is that she's done loads of good things, but like for the wrong reasons. It's actually because she just wants to look good, and you're like, who gives a fuck? Like, that's a good societal reward for doing good things. Like, yeah, Jason is just like a bit of an idiot, and he tried to rob a bank and died in the process. Like, I don't know, none of them have really done anything like assault somebody or...
No.
I don't know. So I've spent the whole time being like, well, if they're in hell, I'm going to be like in a deeper circle of hell. I'm going to be like the 10th circle of hell.
I have to say, it's really hard to explain how I got or why I got addicted so deeply to this program, because... I don't know, in some ways it's quite formulaic until the big twist comes along. Like, not a huge amount happens. The peril doesn't feel that real. I'm not so deeply invested in any of the characters that I would be at all upset if they did go to the real hell, if you know what I mean. But somehow it has this sort of charming blend of really good one-liners and just enough, ooh, what's going to happen next, that just, yeah, I like mainlined it in about 6 days.
Yeah, you're so right. There are some things that I find, like, I feel like the quality goes up and down quite a lot, episode to episode.
Does.
It's not very consistent as a show. And sometimes you'll have watched an episode and you'll be like, what was the point of that? It's obvious when they're inventing plot lines to kind of kill time. Some of it is filler, for sure. But I agree that the one-liners are really, really save it. And I think... Ted Danson as Michael is so good.
He's fantastic.
And he's really... And I also love the Janet character, who's this kind of like almost like AI personal assistant robot non-human thing, that she's just very well performed, very well acted. And so I like the weirdness of her. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, why am I still watching this show? I also really hate the way the credits roll. Because it's only a 20-minute show, the like most climactic bit is obviously like in the last minute or 30 seconds, and it's a really key part of the show. but they make it so the credits roll over that bit, and you're like, hang on, there's still like a big, big bit of information coming, and you're making me feel like I'm being played out of the room. But yeah, apart from that, it's, I don't know, there's obviously something about it that's kept me watching, because I've watched all of it.
Yeah, and now there's no more until January, which I feel very bereft by. I'm similarly annoyed that there's no more Crazy Ex-Girlfriend for a couple of weeks either.
I'm maybe one or two behind.
Yeah, Netflix, what are you doing to me?
So sad. So next week.
Yeah, so next week we are going to have a go at another Netflix thing, which is a Margaret Atwood adaptation. And I don't actually know how to say the title of this.
Me neither.
If anyone knows, please tell us. It is Alias Grace or Elias Grace.
Yeah.
It's an adaptation of a historical novel by Atwood set in Canada about a woman called Grace, I think, who is wrongfully, maybe, we don't know, accused of a serious crime.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know the story of this because I haven't read the book, so I'm quite excited to give it a go.
I have, but a very long time ago, and I cannot remember what happens. So, yeah, and I've seen so many people on Twitter praising this, so yeah, I'm very excited to try it.
Great. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy, and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.